Good afternoon. So last time we were talking about monitors. So monitors was what we called the combination of locks that we've seen before and condition variables and some shared data. Where our idea was we wanted to do operations on the shared data where sometimes those operations would involve waiting for something to be true about the shared data. And to support this, we had this new idea of condition variables. And contrary to the name, the condition variables don't like track a condition or something. Instead, condition variables are basically a list of threads. And by convention, this will be a list of threads that are waiting for a common event to happen. And we'll have operations on that condition variable that sort of let us do that. So we have this wait operation, which adds the current thread to the condition variable, to that list of waiting threads, and simultaneously unlocks this lock and makes sure that when we stop waiting, that we reacquire the lock first. And we saw that kind of our typical pattern for using this is that we'd acquire the lock. We'd see if we have a reason to wait. We would need to acquire the lock before checking for a reason to wait because, well, our reason to wait would always be based on this shared data. We saw one example where the shared data was like this buffer, and we wanted to wait when the buffer was empty. We're not supposed to look at the buffer without the lock because we don't want to get weird results when someone else is editing it. So we'll acquire the lock, make sure it's not changing, check if the buffer is empty, then start waiting. Then we potentially change the data. We saw that we didn't always do this, but that's the most general pattern is, you know, after we are done waiting, we're gonna do something that might, will change the data. And if we change something that might change whether another thread needs to wait, then we will broadcast or sometimes signal a condition variable, which means take a list of a thread on that list and either remove all of them from the list and have them start acquiring the lock and doing whatever it is they were waiting for, or in the case of signal, choose one of those threads to go and do that. We also briefly mentioned counting semaphores kind of as another synchronization construct that provides a way of doing this sort of wait for event operation. We saw like it kind of has this nice natural idea that it corresponds to like you have some number of resources available, the count is how many of those resources, and when the count goes below zero, we wait instead of like decrementing the count below zero. And I asserted without proof that counting semaphores can do everything monitors can do and vice versa. And we're teaching monitors because I think they are easier to use and understand, but not everyone agrees with that. So questions on things we covered last time? Okay, so we're briefly gonna talk about another much higher level synchronization construct that you might see called transactions. And the idea of a transaction is that rather than dealing with, you know, figuring out all this locking stuff, we're just gonna tell something that here's a transaction. So in this example, my transaction is going to be it's gonna be this entire operation that I'm gonna read to balances and set to balances. And this should be a transaction, meaning it should be atomic, meaning it should happen all at once or not at all. We shouldn't have any in-between results. And with the transaction idea, we're gonna say that something that implements transactions, typically a database or some library, is somehow gonna make this happen, make it appear that this is sort of happens all at once. And this is actually a common feature databases will implement. And we're gonna give like a very high level sketch of how you might implement transactions. We're not gonna go into all the details since doing this efficiently is hard. To talk about implementing them, you know, we want to say what does, you know, happens all at once mean? And in fact, there's kind of two common definitions we'll see with transactions. So one idea is what I'll call consistency, that maybe for saying this happens all at once, that other operations that are getting the balance of several accounts will only see the before or after balance. They won't see something in between. You know, if I'm getting a report of the balances printed out at my bank, I'm going to see the balances from after this transfer or before this transfer. I'm not going to see a mix of those. That might be one idea, and that sort of idea is called consistency, and that's something that we'll implement with some sort of locking. Many common systems that implement transactions are also concerned about a different type of happens all at once, which I'll call durability, which is what happens if things crash. So if I am doing this transfer and we lose power, what are the account balances? And what we'll often want to be the case is that if we lose power, you know, I don't expect necessarily that the transfer will have happened, but I do expect that it won't have half happened. You know, that when we come back to our accounts, we'll have either the before transfer money or the after not, a mix of those. Yeah?
What's the difference between a transaction and an atomic operation?
I guess a transaction is a way of making things into atomic operations in effect. When we talk about transactions, we are usually constructing these from things which at the hardware level clearly aren't, you know, atomic to the hardware. Does that answer your question? So when we talk about atomic operations in terms of like a processor, we mean like this instruction, you know, kind of automatically happens all at once, but we're constructing this in cases where we don't have that hardware functionality that can provide that illusion. So we'll just talk about how to implement consistency. If you take the right type of databases class, you'll probably learn about how to implement durability. Not sure if our normal databases class does that, but that's where that topic would be covered, or we can talk about it later. So for implementing consistency, there's actually a very simple solution that works, and that's that we can make our begin transaction, well, we can have a unixt lock, and our begin transaction can lock the lock, and our end transaction can unlock it. This is a way we can implement transactions. It works. The problem is it's pretty unsatisfying because if we're thinking about running a bank, we don't want to actually process all of our, you know, if we're a huge bank, millions of transactions a day, one at a time. So how can we do better than that? And I'll talk about two strategies that let us do that. So one of them is that we can have locks for each individual thing, so like for each account balance. And as we read and write, we acquire locks that we don't have. And at the end of the transaction, we release all the locks. And in the common case, this just works. The problem is, we know we can have deadlock here. So we need some way of recovering from the deadlock. And what we do in this strategy is, because we aren't like doing a consistent lock order, because the lock order depends on the order I wrote this code in, right? If I'm acquiring the lock on each balance. So our deadlock strategy for this would typically be, we just undo everything, go back to begin transaction, try again. And this is actually something databases do. You might say, well, how do we undo everything? That seems really hard. Well, a simple way of doing that is, rather than actually modifying things before the transaction finishes, we'll just keep a list of the modifications we want to make. So to undo the transaction then, we just discard that list. And if we end the transaction without needing to undo it, we just go through that list and actually make all those modifications just at the very end. Another idea is that maybe we don't want to have deadlock sort of happen like that. So something else we might do is we might have a version number for all our values. So when we keep each balance, we'll keep, this is the balance version number 1000 of it.
And then whenever we modify one of those balances, we'll increase the version number. And when we do a transaction in this scheme, we won't actually modify the values right away, just as before, and we won't actually require any locks as we read values. So we'll just record, I read version 1000, and I intend to write a new version. I read version 2000 of this balance, and intend to write a new version. And at the end of the transaction, we'll acquire locks in a consistent order, so there's no deadlock. We'll see if the version numbers have changed since we made our plan. If they have, we'll try again. And this is called optimistic, way of transactions, because we're assuming there's no conflicts. We're assuming that we'll make our plan based on the current values and the current versions, and nothing's going to change until we want to apply that plan. And if it does, we just go to the beginning, redo everything, get new version, get the value, current values that have been updated while we were trying to do this. And so a nice thing about transactions is that we see we have this rather simple interface where we have this super simple implementation where we just have a big lock, and these more sophisticated, higher performance implementations. But from a normal programmer's perspective, all you have to worry about is sort of delimiting when does the transaction start and end, and something like a database handles all of that for you. So questions about the transaction abstraction are sort of very rough sketches of how you might implement it. Okay. So in that case, we're going to move on from concurrency and talk about networking. And in CSO1, most of you did something with sockets that some of you might remember and some of you might not. You had this lab where you use sockets. And the way those sockets worked is you had some funny C code that set up a thing we might call a connection, and it kind of worked like a terminal file. You could read and write from it after the setup. And I'll call this implementing a connection abstraction. It basically looks like we have a program on one machine connected to a program potentially on a different machine, kind of like with a terminal. We have just streams of data that can go in between. And we're going to talk about sort of how that sort of works under the hood as our next topic. And the thing that makes this challenging is that this is not actually the interface that we have with these kind of hardware for the machines to talk to each other. The model for talking between two machines that we sort of start with is less featureful. And I'm going to describe it as kind of the mailbox abstraction. That basically what our kind of raw network lets us do is that we can send what we say is a letter, where we'll have an address we're sending the letter to, and we'll have some data, something in the letter on the network, and the network will arrange for that letter to usually get to the machine it's addressed to. Usually, not always, but usually. And we'll usually say the networks are best effort. That, they're not going to deliberately sabotage our letters, but there's not going to be a guarantee for something like, especially for something like Wi-Fi, that everything you send is going to get there. And well, typically, be dealing with lots of these letters, these messages. So, and we can't actually physically send them all at once. So each sort of machine is going to have a queue, kind of an outgoing mailbox of messages that the hardware will send as it's ready to use the network. And we aren't always ready to receive messages instantaneously, so the hardware will track a list of messages that have been received but haven't been processed yet. So we'll have these queues of messages on either end of messages that haven't made it to the network, or have made it out of the network, but haven't made it to the program on the machine. So So questions about this mailbox model before we try to use it? Yes?
Is there a separate queue for each connection?
Question, is there a separate queue for each connection? So this is a simplified view. You should think about it, I guess, is that this is, with one queue per machine, is kind of the lowest layer, and we might have additional queues implemented on top of that. So if there were a queue for connection, that's where it would be, because this layer, this design here, doesn't know anything about multiple connections. All it knows is about getting to machine B. It doesn't know about getting to different programs on machine B. And we'll see we're going to have an extra step that's invisible to this network implementation that handles that. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Is there any way for machine A to verify that machine B actually got the message?
Question, is there any way for machine A to verify machine B got the message? We will answer that question later. Okay. Other questions? Okay. And so this is basically the interface that the raw internet gives machines. And we know that we're going to implement sockets on top of that. So let's talk about what sockets give us, the model sockets give us. I sort of mentioned it verbally, but I'd like to be more concrete. The idea with sockets is that we have this explicit connection set up where we're going to somehow send a message to start a connection. We'll verify the connection is made. And if you remember from your socket chat lab, the calls to do this were called accept on one end and connect on the other. And once that's set up, we can send things on the connection, and that's associated with the program we originally connected to. The connection tracks all that information. And so we're going to talk about how do we implement this connection abstraction, given that what's really happening is we have this mailbox abstraction. And what we'll see is that the whole implementation of the network is kind of simple functionality being built, things being built atop simple functionality in kind of these steps. So we'll call these sort of steps layers. And the idea is that when we implement, sort of our normal application, so like a web server, it's implemented with sockets. And sockets are what we'll call this transport layer, which provide kind of reliable streams of data, which we know that the lower layers don't have. And those reliable streams of data are in turn implemented atop functionality that knows how to implement the mailbox model across many networks, like across the world, but doesn't understand anything about streams of data. It just knows the mailbox model. And that in turn is going to be implemented atop something that knows how to communicate on the local network, like that handles communicating on the local Wi-Fi network, but doesn't know anything about contacting machines in distant networks. And that, in turn, is going to be implemented atop something that knows how to send bits over the wireless network, but doesn't understand how those bits are going to correspond to individual messages. And so we call each of these layers, and we're going to say that our application layer, like our web server, is built atop a transport layer that handles some of the functionality the web server needs of getting these long streams of data sent reliably, which is built atop this network layer, which handles getting the data to the correct network, so like getting it from the UVA network to the Google network, which is built atop this link layer, which handles once we're on the correct network, how do we get it to the right machine on that network. And that's built atop some physical layer. So we have these sequence of layers, and that's how our network functionality is built. And a big advantage of this is that, we can have multiple implementations of each of these layers for different uses. So Ethernet is for wired connections, and obviously that's very different than what we want to do for a wireless connection like Wi-Fi.
and we have different application protocols. We don't want each application protocol to like re-implement all the functionality. Like, we don't need to re-implement reliable sending of data for SSH if we already have that implementation available to HTTP web servers. We want to just reuse that functionality. Okay, so questions about these layers? Yeah?
So what's like the lowest layer that you can access in like a C program?
What's the lowest layer you can access in a C program? It depends what your OS lets you do. The lowest layer you'll typically access is the transport one, but if your OS, if you use the right interfaces, the OS will probably let you do things at a lower layer, possibly if you only are a system administrator or something. And if your hardware allows it, maybe you can do things below the link layer, but it's unlikely. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So we're going to look, we're going to kind of jump around these layers a little bit, and then we'll kind of look at how they tie together. We're going to first focus on what is going to be our kind of primary thing we're going to look at, which is how do we go from the mailbox model to the connection model, which is what's done in the transport layer. And it's also going to be the subject of a lab in 2 weeks. And the big challenge we have with, you know, going from this mailbox model to this connection stream model is that it's best effort, small messages. So the best effort means that the messages we send, they don't always get there. When they do get there, they don't always get there promptly. And when they do get there, they don't always get there intact. Also, because we're sending these kind of things like letters, there's going to be a size limit on that. So if I want to send a gigabyte of data, the mailbox model I get is not going to let me send a gigabyte letter. I can only send relatively small messages at a time. So I need to divide up my gigabyte into many, many messages. So we'll first start with how do we deal with the case of messages being lost, which we'll get to our question of can we verify the message got there? So let's say I'm going from machine A to machine B. You know, and our normal case is I'm going to send my message, the meeting is at 12 p.m., from machine A to machine B. And in the bad case, that message gets lost in the middle. And here we have a problem, because if we look at everything machine A knows about, machine A knows nothing about the message being lost. As far as it's concerned, this is exactly the same situation in either case, because it sent a message and it didn't see anything bad happen. So to handle this situation, we're going to add a message from machine B to machine A. We'll call an acknowledgement, that basically machine B is going to say, yeah, I got that message. And now that means that these two situations now look different to machine A. That machine A knows if I don't get an acknowledgement, something is wrong. So the way we'll apply this is that machine A is going to choose an amount of time they're willing to wait for an acknowledgement, which we'll call a timeout. And if machine A waits longer than that amount of time, machine A will just send it again. And we'll kind of assume that eventually it gets there. Obviously, in the real world, we have this issue that if machine B is like actually offline, you know, we would just keep trying forever. So in the real world, probably we eventually give up, but we'll just kind of, to keep things simple, assume it either eventually gets there or we never give up. Okay, so I dealt with our message here being lost. Now, something you might realize is, oh, well, this message here, that's another message.
And you said that messages could get lost. So couldn't that message get lost? Absolutely. So what should we do about that? You check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what solution do you like for this problem. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, and D? No clue. Okay, we have quite a split here. So I'm going to argue that C is the best answer. And let me explain my justification here. Like, we can implement a bunch of these. But I think C is the best one to implement. So the problem with A is that then we ask the same question about the what if the got it message is lost. And we need to stop somewhere. Yeah, so we're just going to delay the problem till later. So I don't think A is a good solution, though we can do it, but then we need to, like, eventually we need a different solution. The problem with B is kind of a more fundamental one. Is that from B's point of view, it looks like I received a message and I sent an acknowledgement, in this case where it failed. And that's all that's gonna happen, right? That's all B sees. If we look at the case where it didn't fail, it looks like I received a message and sent an acknowledgement and then nothing happened. So B doesn't have a way, unless we somehow add one, to tell it needs to resend it. So we don't really have a good way of implementing B resending the message. We could try to send every acknowledgement five times or something, and that would probably mostly work, but that's pretty wasteful. So I think C is the best answer, and the thing about C is we've already implemented it. It's free. And why did we already implement it? Let's think about this situation. If I change this drawing to say, instead of this message being lost, we send an acknowledgement and it gets lost, as far as what A knows about here, as far as what A sees, it's exactly the same situation. A can't tell the difference between these two scenarios. So by implementing this timeout, we've already implemented option C for this lost acknowledgement. So this is what we'll do. We'll just say that when we lose the acknowledgement, we're just gonna resend the data because, it's already what we implemented by handling the lost data. Questions about my justification for why I think C is the best choice to implement. Okay, so we have our solution, my proposed solution for the lost acknowledgement, and a complaint you might have about this is, that was easy to implement on A's side, but didn't we make things harder for B? Right? Because if you remember how sockets work, when you did your socket chat server, when you write something to the other side, you don't see two copies of it sometimes. You only get one copy. And we're sending two copies. So B needs some extra work here to handle receiving this message twice. And this is going to get more complicated when we talk about splitting things up into multiple messages. So let's talk about, before we get to splitting things up into multiple messages, let's talk about messages being delayed or reordered. We'll talk about delayed first, since we only have basically one. And messages being delayed is something that's not really going to be a problem yet, except that it will kind of accidentally trigger our timeout, right? The problem with having this timeout approach is that we're kind of guessing, how long do I need to wait for an acknowledgement? And it's very possible I guess way too long. And what I'm going to do in that case is, well, I'm going to send the message too many times. But we already handle this because B needs to handle the, we almost already handle this because B needs to handle things being sent twice from the acknowledgement being lost. And the only weird thing we're going to have happen here is that we can get duplicated acknowledgements on A. So questions on how this scenario works. And we can have something similar happen, you know, on the other side of things, where we send an acknowledgement and the acknowledgement gets delayed, so we, you know, end up resending, you know, from B's perspective, you know, it's sending another acknowledgement because it thinks the first acknowledgement probably was lost, even though it was just late. So let's go to what's going to be a little trickier problem, which is that, well, our messages are limited in size. So far, I've been assuming I can send my whole message, my whole thing, the whole stream of data I have in one message. But we know that that's usually, well, not usually, but often not the case. So if our messages are limited in size, we're not going to be able to do that. We're going to have to split it up into multiple messages. And the most straightforward way of doing this is that, well, we'll just send one message, get it acknowledged, and send the other half of our data in the second message. So I send two messages here, get two acknowledgments. Good. The problem with this scheme is that, you know, it's going to kind of break down if we just do the natural thing on B. And the issue is that, like I told you, that, well, B needs to handle getting duplicates of the message. And this is going to be harder in this case. So here, B gets the meeting and is at 12 p.m., so you can reconstruct the message as the meeting is at 12 p.m. Let's say our first acknowledgments get lost, and B gets two copies of the meeting. If we do the natural thing and just have B concatenate the messages it gets, it reconstructs the message as the meeting. The meeting is at 12 p.m. No, not quite right. Now you might say, oh, well, we should just ignore when we have two the meetings, but, you know, that's a valid message to send, like that reconstructed message. What if we were actually trying to send that? Or something else which just had duplicate words or duplicated values? Like, we still need to support that. So, you know, even though in this case we could solve the problem by saying if it's the same as the last one, ignore it, you know, that doesn't work in general. And there are other versions of this problem we can have. So let's think about them. So let's say our message, initial message is lost. This is actually less of a problem. So we send the meeting, that gets lost, it gets resent, we get an acknowledgement, and we get the is at message. That actually works okay. But if the first message is delayed, we actually run into a worse problem. So let's say I'm sending from A, and I send the meeting, and it gets delayed. It just takes a while to get there. And then I send, I don't get an acknowledgement, so I resend it. I send the meeting.
I get an acknowledgement of that. And then I send is at 12 p.m. Get an acknowledgement of that. Well, B now has gotten that, now thinks our message is the meeting is at 12 p.m., the meeting, because of that delayed message. So that's a problem. And that's a problem we can't, you know, we can't even half solve by disallowing duplicates of the previous message. We would like need to keep track of all the previous messages. So this is bad. And if the acknowledgement of the second message is lost, instead of duplicating the meeting, we duplicate the is at 12 p.m. part. So that's also bad. So questions about sort of these scenarios and what are kind of why we have to reconstruct the wrong message for the last two cases. Why don't we include a unique identifier for message? That is exactly our solution to this. So our solution is that we need to add extra information to the message. This is going to cut down on our usable message size, but that's okay. Identifying which part it is. And now B can figure out which parts are duplicates. So when we have our missed acknowledgement, we can easily say, okay, yep, that I got part one twice, only need one part one. Just use one of them. Now, this still doesn't quite work. And the problem here is that I've put the part numbers on what A is sending, but not on what B is sending. And it's important that we match up which message which acknowledgement is for. So here, we send part one, B acknowledges it, and A set their timeout a little wrong. You know, A was a little too optimistic about how fast A should get the acknowledgement. So A resent part one. And well, from B's perspective, B thinks, oh, A must have lost that first acknowledgement, let me resend it. So B sends his acknowledgement again. And then A sends part two, and that actually gets lost. But as far as A is concerned, well, I sent part one and part two. I got two acknowledgments. I actually sent three messages, but the first one must have gotten lost. Now, A is wrong, but A doesn't have any information to contradict this. So to avoid this situation, we're going to need to not only mark the data parts of the message, but we're going to have our acknowledgments mark what part they're acknowledging. And now A can figure out, oh, I got a second acknowledgement for part one. Okay. You know, I can just ignore that. B must have been acting confused by me resending it. Questions, this scheme here. So this is kind of the basics of getting our streams of data. We split up the stream into these individual messages. We acknowledge, you know, the different parts. So one other thing we need to deal with is messages being corrupted. So occasionally, you know, because what actually happens in a network is kind of our message gets copied from one place to another, and it gets sent over radio and wires that might not be 100% reliable, the bits in our message won't be the same when they come out. Like, usually not, but sometimes. Often enough that if you're transferring like a 10 gigabyte file, you'd be really annoyed if you didn't check for this. And TCP and these protocols that provide reliable streams try to deal with this. And our primary strategy for dealing with it is that we're going to use what are sometimes called checksums. And what we'll do is we'll choose some hash function, and we'll take a hash of the message.
And rather than sending the original message, we'll send this hash and the original message. When we receive the message, we will recompute this same hash function value. And if it doesn't match, well, either the message was changed, something here changed, or something in the hash changed. And we'll just say, well, something went wrong. Let's ignore this. And the simplest thing we can do is we can just pretend the message was lost. Yes, we can maybe do something more sophisticated about this, of like saying, hey, you tried to send me something and it didn't get there correctly, why don't you resend it? But the simplest thing we can do is we can just act as if it was lost, and we know we can already recover from messages being lost. That'll handle the problem. And this, you know, is the primary way we deal with this. You might observe, if you're thinking about this hard, that, you know, this assumes that when we have sort of the message corrupted, that it's not corrupted in a way where the hash still matches. And we know hashes have collisions, so this is, it's possible that that won't happen. And how do we control that? Well, if you want to lower the probability of that happening, you choose a bigger hash. And the question is, how much probability are you comfortable with? And these hashes are called checksums, commonly. That's a common name you'll see for them. And that's because in TCP and UDP, the hash function actually is a sum. In other protocols, like Ethernet, it is not. It is something else. So we've shown you kind of now all the tools to deal with all these types of failures, implement kind of these reliable streams of data like you see with TCP connections, with sockets that you may or may not remember from CS01. There's some additional things going on in the real implementation, and that's mainly to solve this issue that what I've shown you so far, it works, but it's pretty slow. And the main reason it's pretty slow is that we send one message, we completely process that message before moving on to the next message. And if we're like sending a message across the country, this is gonna take a while. So what we want to do instead is send a whole bunch of messages, like not just send part one, wait until that's acknowledged, then send part two, but send like parts 1 through 50. And then as they get acknowledged, you know, start sending parts 50 to 60, 60 to 70, and so on. So if you take a networking class, you'll learn more about how that works. And a big challenge in doing that that comes up there is that, well, how many parts can we send? Like, what? Because if we do too many, we're going to overload the network. And this problem is called congestion control, and it's probably the biggest reason why this is challenging. In practice, is that, you know, we have to figure out how many to send, and, you know, it varies, right? If I have a slow connection, it should be a lower number than if I have a fast connection, and we want to kind of detect that automatically. Okay. So let's go back to our layers here. So I told you that, you know, we talked about our transport layer. And we're going to start looking at some of these lower layers. So we have that mechanism for implementing reliability in streams of data, and we saw it was implemented on top of this send message to machine functionality. And that send message to machine functionality, that's what we'll call our network layer, that's implemented on top of this link layer and so on. And our application layers are implemented on top of this transport layer. But this picture is actually maybe a little too simple. And one way in which it's too simple is that often we'll have more layers than that. And some in inconsistent ways. So for example, HTTPS is this HTTP, this web serving protocol, on top of TLS, which provides encryption, which is also on top of TCP, that reliable streams, and so on. So we have this sort of two layers here that in this picture seem like application layers kind of on top of each other. And we can have even more layering like that. So for example, many web browsers do DNS, which is something we'll talk about later, over HTTP, over TLS, over TCP. So we have even more layers. And if you like, use VPNs, well, a VPN is basically providing IP over UDP again. So we have like two different network layers put on top of each other. So this layering doesn't always quite work out in the real world. But this is kind of the base, the things we usually see on the internet. Okay. And one thing that's going to come up is that we're going to talk about machine names and addresses. So I've been like showing us that, I contact machine A from machine B and machine B from the machine A. But when we actually contact machines, we need to specify some information to specify the machine. And the form that information takes is it's going to be an address. And we're actually going to see kind of two different types of machine addresses. We're going to see ones for the network layer, and well, there also are some different types of addresses used for the link layer. And these addresses aren't the names of the machines, so we'll have a separate naming scheme, and we'll talk briefly about how does that correspond to the addresses. And we'll also have a similar kind of dichotomy, and we'll have kind of what we'll call port numbers to identify services, which are basically addresses for a program on a machine, where the name of that will be different. So we have these different names than addresses, and this is very similar to what you see in assembly, right? You might have a variable called counter, but the actual machine to use that variable, it wants an address, it wants a number, because that's how it can locate it. And we have the same thing with machines on our network that will see the networking hardware wants a number to locate the machine, not a name. So let's look at kind of how these layers work. And I'm going to show an example here. This is an Ethernet frame. So if I have a wired connection from one machine to another, these are a representation of the bits that might be sent over that wire to represent one message. And here we have some addresses in the message to let the machines that are on this wire know who it's from and to. So we have a destination address, which is a MAC address. And a MAC address is an address that is associated with a particular piece of hardware that is used, as I said, at the link layer. And basically every single Wi-Fi chip card and Ethernet card has its own MAC address hard-coded. And we also have the source, and we have a type. And in this example, that type corresponds to the internet protocol. So the data for the frame, so from the link layer, this is what the link layer sees. The link layer sees I'm sending to this MAC address from this MAC address on the wire. But the data it's sending is going to be interpreted by the next layer up, the network layer. And the network layer is going to have its own information. It has a length. It has an indication about what type of packet is inside it, what transport layer is in use. And it has its own source and destination address, which is where it's trying to send it from and to. And our MAC address, like this is for on the wire, on this wire. And this is sort of across the internet. So we have different types of addresses for those two uses. And then we have some data for that packet. And probably the reason the implementation of IP sent this packet is because it was asked to by a transport layer like TCP. So in this case, we have inside the data for that packet, we have the TCP segment, which has its own metadata. And it has these things called port numbers, which identify a program on the machines on either end of the connection, and we have a sequence number, which is the same part number you saw earlier, and some other information, and then finally the actual application data. So you can see the way these layers work is basically the upper layers call the lower layers to send things. And so things get wrapped in this, you know, wrapped over and over again before they actually end up on a wire or over the radio. Okay, so questions about sort of our nested messages here? Okay. So let's talk about what the network layer does. We alluded that it gets messages between networks. And there's two versions of the network layer that are in common use. They're both the internet protocol. Internet for it goes between networks, internetwork. And there's version 4 and version 6 that are both in common use today. And they both have addresses that are numbers. But maybe they're not obviously numbers. So in IP version 4, they're 32-bit numbers. But the way we write those 32-bit numbers is by taking each 8-bit part of them and writing them out as a decimal number. So they might look like this. It's really represented as a number. When it's sent like over the network, it's just a single number. We just write it in a certain way by convention. And these addresses are assigned centrally to organizations in these big blocks. And also, as we'll talk about a little later, some of them are reserved for non-use outside the internet on private local networks. Now, IPv4 had this problem that they chose 32-bit numbers. And 2 to the 32 is not that large compared to the world population. And there's been a lot of demand for the internet. So we came up with IPv6, where we said, we don't want to run out of numbers. So we're going to make the numbers way bigger. So IPv6 has 128-bit numbers. And it just writes the addresses in a different way. So it writes them in hexadecimal in groups of 16 bits. And to save space, long strings of zeros can be represented by doubled colons. So here, this doubled colon here expands to this whole long string of zeros, just so we can write the address more compactly. So. So that's the general form of these addresses. And there's also going to be, in both IPv4 and IPv6, there are going to be some addresses that are special. So we mentioned for IPv4, we have some of these reserved for non-internet use. IPv6 has some similar ones. So for example, all zeros and a one represents localhost, meaning the current machine. It doesn't go on the network, actually. And everything starting with FE80 represents machines on the local network, and it doesn't go across the internet ever. So we have these addresses, which are numbers. And I mentioned they were assigned in blocks. They're assigned in these big blocks. And there's a reason for that, which is that this is how we're going to implement our central network layer functionality of getting a packet to the right machine. So we'll have these machines we call routers that are connected to several networks. And those routers will have this thing we'll call a routing table, where they'll look up the destination address of a packet they get and say, what do I do with it? So for example, let's say a packet comes in off network 3 here, and it's for guest IP is 128.143.2.5, or, you know, we're going to say, okay, well, that's in this range here, so what am I going to do with that packet? I'm going to copy it to network 1, and I'm going to send it to a machine here on network 1, you know, forward it to where that machine that's on network 1, 11.4.3.2. And the nice thing about this design is that we just need to fill in these routing tables, which is not trivial. If you take a networking class, we'll talk about how can we, you know, share the information to do that. But once we've done that, there's no, like, the actual process of moving a packet across the network doesn't involve any big coordination. We've all done it when we made these routing tables. It's all just these simple local decisions. I just look it up in a table, do what that says, I'm done. I don't need to, like, trace the path to the machine. It's all pre-computed here. And because we have these big blocks of IP addresses that are all related to each other, this table is not too huge. It's obviously not small. If you're a big ISP, the numbers I've heard are like 300,000 entries. If you're not a big ISP, much, much more. But, you know, that sort of size, which is doable. Yeah. Question, are those devices the router sending packet to other routers? Most likely, yes. So basically, we'll have this other router, 11.4.3.2. It will send the packet to it. It will actually send it to it using its MAC address because it's on the same network. And this will probably be connected to several other networks too. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So this is how we deal with things that need to go across the internet. As I mentioned, there are IP addresses that are reserved for not going across the internet. So one you'll probably come across practically, I guess two sets you'll come across practically. One is localhost. So in IPv4, everything starting with 127 is the current machine. It doesn't go on the internet, it just stays on the current machine. The idea is you can contact programs on your current machine using the same interface you use to contact programs on another machine. Then we have these addresses, which are private IP addresses. And you'll commonly see these used in networks where they don't have enough IPv4 addresses for the real internet. So they'll do what's called network address translation, where we will have a router that, rather than just copying packets to their destination, will also map these private addresses to a smaller set of public addresses to deal with the fact that, well, you know, if I only have 10 IP addresses and I have 1,000 people, I can't give each of those 1,000 people their own IP address. So I need to somehow share my 10 IP addresses across those 1,000 people. There are also some IP addresses that are reserved for use on the local network only, that you might occasionally see if you, like, look up a configuration. You might say, where did I get this 169.254? That's a local network only address. Okay, so questions on our network layer, sort of basic idea. So we talked about as kind of our primary topic, implementing the reliability part of the transport layer. But you can see here, I've specified there's another thing we need to do, and that's implementing this reaching the correct program part of our transport layer. And we alluded to what that was going to be when we talked about port numbers. So let's talk a little more detail about port numbers. So the problem with IP addresses is that often I'm running multiple things on one machine. So for example, if my machine has an SSH server and a web server, I need to know when I open a connection, which one do I want to contact, the SSH server or the web server? Or if I open up 12 SSH windows, the SSH server needs to know which SSH window do I send this data back to? So to identify those sort of individual programs or individual connections, we're going to use port numbers. And in TCP and UDP, that's used on the internet, these are 16-bit numbers. And you can kind of think of them like a PO box. You know, they're going to all go to the same place, but we're going to distribute it based on this number. And by convention, the lower port numbers are kind of assigned manually. So we'll just say that if I'm using SSH and I don't specify a port number, the canonical port number is 22, and that's just kind of reserved manually. That port number 22 is for SSH. Port number 80 is for HTTP, and so on. But we often need to allocate port numbers dynamically. So if I open a connection to an SSH server, the SSH server needs to send stuff back to the correct SSH client. So the SSH client needs a port number. So the operating system will allocate port numbers typically from the higher end of the addresses dynamically to programs as needed. And one thing I noticed here is I listed TCP and UDP. So TCP implements the reliability in streams we saw. But sometimes we might want to write a program where we don't want the reliability. We don't want streams of data. So for example, if I'm sending real-time audio, maybe if I lose a packet, I just want to get the next audio. I don't want to keep resending the old audio. Let's just get to the current stuff. So I might deliberately not want all that acknowledgement stuff. I just might want to say, that's too slow. I just care about having the latest data if it's available, or just, you know, play static. So to support applications where we don't want that, there's a protocol called UDP, which basically just implements the port number idea, but doesn't do any of the streams or reliability. So UDP is unreliable. It just kind of wraps your message up and, you know, gives you access to the network, but it adds port numbers so we can have multiple programs on one machine. It doesn't give you a stream of data, so each time you write something in UDP, it has to fit in the message. And it's going to be sent in separate messages. So if you write A and write B in TCP, that's exactly the same as writing A and B together. You know, an A and B might be sent in two messages, they might be sent in one. It's up to the OS to decide that. With UDP, they have to be sent separately, because each one is a separate message. And also, like, each of them can be lost independently. And also, because UDP is unreliable, it doesn't have a notion of connecting to a server. So you can have one UDP socket that connects to, that sends messages to lots of different hosts and receive messages from lots of different machines. Okay, so that's briefly UDP. So usually we use TCP because it's a lot easier to use, but if TCP, if you don't like the performance impact of all that reliability and streaming support, you might deliberately use UDP. So we have these TCP and UDP connections, and one thing that used to happen is that the OS, when it gets a message coming in, it needs to figure out, how do I get that message to the right program? And generally what we'll do is we'll track our open connections, be they TCP or UDP, via what's sometimes called a five tuple. We have our protocol, and we have our local address and our remote address for that. And basically, the OS is going to have a big table of all of these and the corresponding socket. And we can, in fact, get a dump of that table on Linux with the netstat command. So here we can see, here are all the sockets on the system that use, that are connected and use IPv4 and IPv6. And we can see that Linux is tracking a local address, colon, a port number, and a remote address, colon, a port number. In this case, we can see, oh, this is port 22. That's, if you remember from a slide earlier, that's SSH. So this is probably my SSH client. It's been assigned a local port number in that high 49,000 range, and it's connected to a remote server on port 22, and it's using the TCP protocol. And when a packet comes in, that's part of this connection. Linux is going to check the IP addresses in the packet and the port numbers in the packet, match them up against this table, and it's going to say, oh, that goes to this socket, which is, corresponds to this program. That's the program I want to finish its receive call now. So something you'll notice if you run this command, we also have, some of these are in the state established, so that makes sense. We have a connection. Some of them are in this time wait state. So what that is about is when we close a connection, we need to do some extra work to deal with what if there's delayed packets for the connection. The time wait state is how the OS is tracking that this is closed, but I still need to do some extra work in case there are delayed packets. That's what the time wait state means. Is that the socket is not actually open, but the OS still needs to track it in case there's delayed packets for it. So far, this looks all like sockets that sort of have a local and remote address. But if you think about how servers work, if you remember the chat server assignment, what you did in the chat server assignment is you had one end which made a socket that wasn't connected yet, and you accepted a connection. And when we accept a connection, that means we have to match the connection request to that socket. So how do we track that information? Well, when we have a socket that isn't connected to anything, we still track those in this table. We just have kind of a wildcard entry for the remote address. So we can see that here, that we have all these sockets that have a foreign address that has this placeholder value of all zeros, meaning anything, and a placeholder port number of anything. And also, we have UDP sockets that aren't connected to anything, but still run. So the OS will know to match these sort of wildcard addresses and realize, okay, you know, I have a connection request coming in for, say, port 4199. I don't care where it comes from because this matches any remote address. So the other thing you'll notice here is that sometimes we have a local address of 127.0.0.1. That's the localhost one, so that only works from the local machine. Sometimes we have this zero address, and you might say, surely your IP address isn't zero. And you're right, it isn't. That's used to represent take connections going to any of my IP addresses. So usually, our machine only has one useful IP address, but we can have multiple. So for example, if my laptop's on Wi-Fi and plugged into an Ethernet cord, I have two internet accessible IP addresses, quite possibly. And so the socket interface handles that, and the OS needs to handle that. So that's why we don't have the internet address there is just anything. Some questions? Seconds, yeah.
What's the receive queue and send queue?
That is the size of messages that are, or data that is buffered in the kernel that hasn't gotten to the application yet. So in these cases, my applications are all sort of either have read everything that has the OS has received from the network, and everything they've sent, the OS has sent to the network. But if that's not, wasn't the case, these numbers would be higher. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah, and I guess this is in the netstat output because I think sometimes system administrators might be concerned, why is all my memory being used on my big web server? And this could sometimes be a reason. Okay, so for our last topic today, let's revisit the issue of names versus addresses. So I mentioned we have these addresses here. So we have these IP addresses, which were designed so routers could easily look them up in a table and figure out where to send data. And we had these MAC addresses that corresponded to particular pieces of hardware, so they were useful on the local network to make sure we got to a particular piece of hardware that to receive our message. But we want to have these nicer names. So how do we go from these nicer names that we've probably seen before to those IP addresses? And the way that's done is with the domain name system, or DNS. And DNS is a distributed database. So the typical way DNS would work is that I would connect to a network, through, say, some internet service provider. And as part of connecting to that, I'll get an address of a DNS server that's probably operated by my internet service provider. And let's say I go to my web browser, I decide to load www.cs.virginia.edu. My web browser is going to make a request to my ISP's DNS server saying, you know, I like the address for www.cs.virginia.edu. And probably my ISP does not keep track of the address of every single website I could go to. So it instead is going to need to look that up somewhere. And the way we're going to handle that is we're going to have some designated servers called the root DNS servers that are going to give us the information to find any name on the internet. So my ISP's DNS server on my behalf is going to contact the root DNS server and say, hey, I'd like to look up www.cs.virginia.edu. And the root DNS server isn't actually going to know that because, well, it would be kind of impractical to have one set of servers that know all the names on the internet. So instead, what it's going to do is it's going to say, well, I don't know that, but there's this server that knows about all the EDU stuff. Contact that server. And so it will go to the ISP server, will contact the EDU server, EDU DNS server. And it's going to say, well, I don't actually know about that because I don't manage UVA's network. But I know where Virginia.edu's DNS server is. Why don't you contact it? And then we contact Virginia.edu's DNS server, and well, the CS stuff, that's managed separately. So it's gonna say, well, I don't know that, but you can contact the cs.virginia.edu DNS server, and it's gonna tell you. And eventually, you know, we'll get back, you know, the actual name here. So we'll send back the address equals something, and we'll send that back. So that's how we got the name. But obviously, if we do this all the time, this is pretty inefficient. You know, so we'll speed this up, and the main way we'll speed this up is that we don't need to ask for this information every time. So for example, once I'm told by the root DNS server that, hey, that's an EDU address, you should go to the EDU server, I can just remember that for a while. So what our ISP's DNS server will do is it will remember that information, and every once in a while, we'll see if there's a different DNS server for EDU, but it won't keep contacting the root server every time. It'll just remember, oh, this is an EDU address. I know about EDU DNS servers. I'll go there first. And it will do the same idea of remembering the information for a while for every level of this hierarchy. So in the typical case, you know, it will hopefully be able to respond without contacting another server. But when it needs the information, in the worst case, it can go to the root server and go to this full hierarchy of servers. And that will get its result. And, you know, something you'll notice about this design is that the hierarchy kind of manages who's likely to run the servers, right? That we'll have a different organization responsible for EDU URLs. Virginia.edu is going to run things separately from VT.edu, so we'll have separate servers. CS runs stuff separately from the rest of the university's IT, so we have separate servers. So this kind of way of splitting things up kind of naturally fits with how the actual system, you know, it divides up the responsibility nicely, and that, you know, so it makes this practical to administer. Because if I want to change what www.cs.virginia.edu is with this design, how do I change it? I change it here. And that's going to be run by exactly the right people for changing that. Versus having to like go to the root server. No, don't have to do that. I just change it on the server cs.virginia.edu runs. So that's where I'll finish up today. So next time we'll talk about a few more minor remaining networking topics and move on to talking a little about security.